I'm here with Mark Charles. He's running as an independent for President of the United States. Mark, please feel free to further introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. So, Yat-e, Mark Charles Yenishya. Tsin Bake Dene Nishle, Doto Higlini Bashichin. Tsin Bake Dene Dashache, Doto Chini Dashanella. In the Navajo culture, when we introduce ourselves, we always give our four clans. We're a matrilineal people, and our identities come from our mother's mother. So my mother's mother happens to be American of Dutch heritage, and so I say Tsin Bake Dene. Translated, it means I'm from the Wooden Shoe People. My second clan, my father's mother, is Toi Higlini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Tsin Bake Dene. Then my fourth clan, my father's father, is Toi Chitni, and that's the Bitterwater clan. It's one of the original clans of our Navajo people. I also just want to acknowledge today, since I'm in a new area and I'm been living in Washington, D.C., but I'm back in the Southwest and we're in Albuquerque, New Mexico, recording this interview. And I want to just acknowledge that we are on the land of the Pueblos. And the Pueblo people of the Southwest, and especially of New Mexico, have done an incredible job of sustaining these lands and of honoring these lands and of upholding both the language and the culture and the traditions of their people here. And I am deeply honored for the work that the Pueblos have done, and it's an honor for me to be here on their lands today.
Thank you for that. Mark, what is your experience that you think qualifies you for the country's highest executive office?
Well, I have been a student of our country for a long time. I was a history major in college, and I studied at UCLA. I was a history major there. And I have done a lot of work on both the religious history of our nation as well as the political and kind of the military history and the social history of our country. And about maybe 15 years ago, I moved with my family, where I was pastoring a church in Denver, Colorado. And we moved back to the Navajo Nation. And we lived in a very remote community on our nation, on our reservation lands. We were about 6 miles off the nearest paved road, on a dirt road. We were in a community that had no running water, no electricity. Our neighbors were rug weavers and shepherds. And moving there, we prepared ourselves, my wife and I and our son, we prepared to live off the grid. We prepared to haul water. We prepared to cook over a camp stove or over an open fire. We prepared to live by candlelight or kerosene lamp. We prepared to use an outhouse and all the things of that life. But the thing that caught us by surprise, the thing that completely startled me, was how completely marginalized and even forgotten by the rest of the nation we felt once we got to the reservation. I quickly learned that very few non-natives come to the reservation. And those who do come, most of them come for one of two purposes. They come to take our picture, or they come to give us charity. Very few people come to really get to know us as people and to actually build a long-term relationship with us. So while I was living there, I began to experience this, and my eyes began to open up to more of the true history of our nation. And I was being exposed at that time both through the work of Stephen Newcomb, who wrote a fantastic book on the doctrine of discovery called Pagans in the Promised Land, as well as through other study committees and groups I was a part of. I began learning about this doctrine of discovery and how deeply this doctrine influenced the foundations of the country. While I was living there, I also realized that because we were so marginalized, that you could become president of the United States without ever campaigning to Native peoples. And I witnessed two presidential elections from the reservation, and no one stopped on the reservation to actually speak to us. The Navajo Reservation, we are the largest land-based reservation in the country. We're the second largest tribe numerically. We occupy about 27,000 acres, I believe it is. If we were a state, we'd be the 10th largest state in size. And we have about 300,000 rural tribal members. But because we reside in the Four Corners with lands in Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, and we don't make up a single congressional district in each of those states, we have almost no impact on the Electoral College. And so therefore, we are not campaigned to. Now, most reservations are tiny compared to ours. And so again, Native peoples do not get campaigned to. If you listen to presidential candidates, you will hear them say, I'm going over here to get the African-American vote. I'm going here to get the white male vote. I'm going here to get the woman's vote. I'm going here to get the Latino, the Hispanic vote. I'm going over here to get these other, but you will never hear them say, I'm going here to get the Native American vote. And that's because of the way our numbers have been so decimated throughout history, as well as we've been so marginalized and spread out throughout the country that we don't impact the Electoral College. And because of that, and because of the depth of the history, most of the country doesn't know what the history of the United States actually is. Most people have a sense that, yeah, we didn't treat the natives very well, but they don't know how bad it actually was. So in 1851, Peter Burnett, who was the first governor of California, in his first State of the State address, he said that a war of extermination is taking place between the white and the Indian races and will continue until the Indian race becomes extinct, must be expected. And while we cannot anticipate the result but with painful regret, the inevitable destiny of the race is beyond the wisdom or the power of man to avert. Now, he's not saying a famine's broken out, it's not raining, and these people are dying. He's not saying there is a disease that's broken out and we can't contain it and the people are dying. He's saying we can't stop killing them. And this is going to continue until the Indian race becomes extinct. This was in 1851. In 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Pacific Railway Act. And this act allots the land and the resources to get the Transcontinental Railway and Telegraph Lines, which has made it up to Omaha, Nebraska. It gets it the rest of the way to the Pacific Ocean. Within 2.5 years, 3 years of signing that bill, President Lincoln has ethnically cleansed. After the hanging of the Dakota 38 and the Dakota War, he has nullified the treaties of the tribes in Minnesota and removed them from Minnesota. After the Sand Creek Massacre, he has ethnically cleansed and removed the Cheyenne and Arapaho from Wyoming and Colorado into Oklahoma. And the Long Walk in New Mexico, where he's removed the Mescalero Apache and the Navajo, he has ethnically cleansed the states of Minnesota, Colorado, and New Mexico, which are three of the primary routes of the first railways for the Transcontinental Railway, making Abraham Lincoln one of the most genocidal presidents in the history of our nation. We don't talk about this.
So, what makes you qualified to run for president?
If you listen to political debate today, you will hear the Democrats screaming at the Republicans and the Republicans screaming at the Democrats. Immigration reform, gun control, Roe versus Wade, economic disparity, all these issues that they love to scream about each other at. But no one will take the issue down to the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is our foundations. It's this doctrine of discovery. In 1452, between 1452 and 1493, the Catholic Church wrote a series of papal bulls, or official edicts of the Church. Essentially, it was the Church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever lands you find not ruled by white European Christian rulers, those people are less than human and their land is yours to take. This is literally the doctrine that European nations go into Africa, colonize the continent, and enslave the people, as well as allowed Columbus, who was lost at sea, to land in a new world and claim to have discovered it. You can't discover lands already inhabited. So this reveals the implicit racial bias of the nation, which is Native peoples, people of color, aren't fully human. The Declaration of Independence, 30 lines below the statement, all men are created equal, refers to Natives as merciless Indian savages. The Constitution, which begins with the words, we the people, Article 1, Section 2, never mentions women, specifically excludes Natives, and counts Africans as three-fifths of a person. In 1823, John Marshall, on the Supreme Court, writes an opinion ruling that the doctrine, our discovery, is what gives title to the land, and then references this doctrine of discovery to state that Natives, who were here first but are savages, we only have what's called the right of occupancy to land, while Europeans have the fee title to the land, the right of discovery to the land, and therefore they're the true title holders. This puts the doctrine of discovery as the legal precedent for land titles that gets referenced by the Supreme Court in 1954, 1985, and most recently in an opinion written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 2005, saying the Oneida Indian Nation cannot have sovereignty over their own lands because of the doctrine of discovery. So most candidates would like to tell you that the United States of America struggles with racism, sexism, and white supremacy in spite of our foundations, and then they'll blame it on the other party. When the truth is, the United States of America is white supremacist, racist, and sexist because of our foundations. And nobody is willing to take the problem down to the root.
Is your plan to get rid of the Constitution or?
My plan is to say we have to look at the foundations this nation was built on. You want to understand why women earn anywhere between, depending on how you count, between 50 and 80 cents to the dollar? Well, read the Constitution. There's 51 gender-specific male pronouns. Who is protected by the Constitution, who can run for office, who can hold office. There's not a single female pronoun in the entire Constitution. You want to understand why our prisons are filled with people of color? Read the 13th Amendment. It doesn't abolish slavery. It says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime, whereas the party has been duly convicted. We never abolished slavery. We merely redefined and codified it under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system. This is why our prisons are filled with people of color. You want to understand, you know, the Constitution. In 2010, the Supreme Court sided with Citizens United and rules that corporations now have the same rights to political free speech as individuals, opens the door for super PACs, unlimited support of candidates. This shouldn't surprise us. The Constitution's doing what it was designed to do. It's protecting the interests of white landowning men. And so if we want to fix the problems we're facing today, we have to address it at the root. This isn't a Democrat or Republican problem. This isn't a Trump or a Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders problem. This is a problem with the foundations the nation was built on. And nobody is willing to take the conversation there. And this is what I'm trying to do with my campaign. And I'm beginning to say that if we want to fix the problems that we're facing, and we're facing some enormous problems, if we want to really fix them, we have to look at our foundations and decide how we're going to address them. So on my website, my personal website, wirelesshogan.com, about 4 years ago, I published an article. And I took the Constitution. And it's great that we can amend the Constitution. But amendments don't always work. It took two amendments to get women the right to vote. We still haven't abolished slavery. It's 2019. Slavery's still legal in the United States. The 13th Amendment did not do that job. So while it's good we can amend the Constitution, amending it doesn't work. Because you still have the racist, the sexist, the white supremacist language, and then you have a footnote at the end that says, oh, actually, every place where it says he, him, or his, it should say them, the them, theirs, or you know, something else. And so I'm advocating we have to edit this document. So I have a version of the Constitution on my website where I went through the Constitution with a strike-through font. Every male pronoun, I put a strike-through font. Not him, there. Not his, the president's or the congresspersons or something else. Every clause that's racist or sexist or white supremacist, like the 13th Amendment, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime. Just a strike-through font through that clause. There's no reason why we have to justify slavery in some other place outside of chattel slavery. And so if you read through this document that's on my website, you'll see where if we just strike through some of these words, rather than adding an amendment to the end, we need to actually go. So when you read it, you can say, yeah, we used to be sexist, but now we're trying not to be. We used to be white supremacists, now we're trying not to be. And you get it in your first read-through of the document. This is one of the proposals I'm putting forward. I'm not saying get rid of the Constitution, but we have to work on this foundational level document in some pretty dramatic ways if we want to fix the problems that we're facing today.
So that would be day one, the first step.
Well, actually, my proposal, one of the things at the center of my platform is I'm advocating that the United States of America needs a national dialogue on race, gender, and class. A conversation I would put on par with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that happened in South Africa and Rwanda and in Canada. I wouldn't call ours Truth and Reconciliation, though, because that's a misnomer. Reconciliation implies there was a previous harmony. If you understand our history, that didn't exist. That's part of the mythology of American history. So I would call ours Truth and Conciliation. Conciliation is merely the mediation of a dispute. So we need a National Truth and Conciliation Commission, and I think we need one sooner rather than later. And that is at the center of my campaign. If we want to deal with these problems, we have to understand this history. There's an Aboriginal leader, a Native leader from Canada. His name is George Erasmus. And he says where common memory is lacking, where people do not share in the same past, there can be no real community. If you want to build a community, he says, you have to start by creating a common memory. I love that quote, and I think it gets to the heart of our nation's problem with race, which is we have a white majority population that remembers a mythological history of discovery, expansion, opportunity, and exceptionalism. And we have communities of color that have the lived experience of stolen lands, broken treaties, slavery, Jim Crow laws, internment camps, mass incarceration, segregation, boarding schools, Indian massacres, families separated at our borders, and there's no common memory. And you don't have to look very far to see how bleak the sense of community is on a national level. And so I am looking for ways to get our nation talking to one another again, creating this common memory, having this national dialogue, acknowledging our history for what it is so that we can understand it and find a way to move forward from it.
What role does Christianity play in your campaign?
So one of the things I advocate, and one of the biggest challenges, if you look at the history of the United States, where we talk about we have a separation of church and state, but we actually don't. And I tell audiences everywhere I go around the country, if you don't understand the history of the church, you will never understand the history of the United States. Now, back in the 4th century is when Constantine was emperor of Rome. And thank Constantine, which side of the camp you're on, for the creation of Christendom, this Christian empire. Now, in my research, which is coming out in my book, which is due out November 5th, it's called Unsettling Truth, The Ongoing Dehumanizing Legacy of the Doctrine of Discovery. If you look at the writings of the Bishop of Caesarea, his name is Eusebius, who was the priest or the bishop who baptized Constantine. In his writings, in the book titled Ecclesiastical History, he actually props up Constantine as a God-ordained emperor of Rome. And I argue he does it because the great persecution of 303 AD touched him personally, and he wanted to end the persecution. And he did that by siding up next to the most powerful emperor in the world and propping him up as God-ordained emperor for such a time as this. So he created this notion of Christian empire. Now, if you read the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament, Jesus was adamant. There is no such thing as Christian empire. He did not come to create a Christian empire. He came to plant a church. He came to offer his body as a living sacrifice. He came even to be persecuted. He did not come to legislate his faith and to create a ruling governmental Christian society. And so this notion of Christendom, Christian empire, is a heresy. It's a false teaching of the teachings of Christ. And it's this heresy of Christian empire, which is what the church has become. And that's the church that wrote the Doctrine of Discovery, and that's the church, by and large, here in the United States, that accepts, even embraces, this heretical teaching known as Christian Empire.
Are you a Christian?
A Christian, yes. I am deeply embarrassed and ashamed of what the church has done because of this belief in Christendom, in Christian Empire. And so what I argue in my writings and in my teachings around the country is the goal is not to make the nation Christian. That's not the goal. Just like the goal is not to make the nation any other religion. The nation is a secular state that has to find some way to get this plurality of people living together in some sort of harmony, or at least some sort of peaceful existence. And that's a very different goal than what you have the church doing, which is, you know, the church is to convert people, or the church is to kind of influence people into a certain way of living and a certain way of life. But that's not the goal of the nation. And so while I think you can have a leader of a nation who is of a Christian faith, of a Muslim faith, of a Hindu faith, or even an atheist or some other faith, but as long as their goal is not to make the nation reflect that faith. And so I tell people, I am a Christian who is running for president. I am not trying to become a Christian president. My goal is not to make the nation Christian. In fact, most of the problems we're facing today comes from this heresy of Christian Empire, where the church was trying to make the nation Christian, whether it's through the justification of slavery, or whether it's through the taking Native children out of the home and putting them into these military-style boarding schools. All these attempts to Christianize these heathens, these pagans, are what caused the problem we're facing today.
A lot of people vote based on single issues, like abortion or taxes or immigration. And I'm curious if I get that you're trying to do a history lesson that is, you know, massively overdue and needed. But when it comes down to, you know, how this election is going to roll out, it's going to be based on issues, sometimes wedge issues, sometimes not as controversial. And mm-hmm. So I want to hear your opinions and your feelings on hot button issues like abortion and immigration.
So this is the problem. We have a very simplistic political system. It's a two-party system, and it turns every dialogue binary. So whether it's Roe versus Wade, whether it's gun control, whether it's immigration, and neither party is interested in solving the problem. They merely want to get the other party out of power and get themselves back into power. And most of the nation does decide how to vote based on a single issue, which is tragic. So in this last debate with the Democrats just a few weeks ago, they were posed questions, and they had 60 seconds to answer with a 30-second follow-up. You cannot articulate a solution to the complex ethical, moral, political, social, military issues that we are facing today in 60 seconds. In 60 seconds, you can get out a soundbite that gets the support of your base and riles up the other side. You can raise some money in 60 seconds. You can mock people in 60 seconds. You cannot lay out a platform to govern in 60 seconds. But this is how people want to look. And one of the reasons I ran for I'm running for president, and one of the reasons I'm running as an independent, is because every 4 years we have these debates about who we are and where we're going. And in our history, if you go back and read the Lincoln-Douglas debates, for example, as horrid as they were, both Lincoln and Judge Douglas were blatant white supremacists who didn't give a crap about black lives. But if you read their debates were a series of three speeches, where the first candidate gave a speech for anywhere between 30 and 40 minutes. The second candidate responded with a speech of about an hour. And the first candidate came back again with a response speech of about 20 to 30 minutes. A series of three speeches where you could actually lay out what you're thinking and what you're trying to do. And this is what I'm trying to do with this campaign. So I am actually being very cautious to not say this is where I land on each of these issues right now, because if I do that, if I tell you I'm pro this, I'm anti this, or I'm for this, or I'm against that, people will automatically put me in one of their binary camps, and then they will stop listening to me, and they will either love me and support me with all their money, or they will try to tear down my campaign with everything they have. And that's not going to lead to a healthy solution to the problem. One of the things I'm saying is that we have to have a nuanced, balanced, in-depth debate on all of the issues and understand how they came out of our history. So on the 4th of July, I actually gave about an hour and a half online live YouTube stream where I talked about some of our history. And one of the questions that people are asking me frequently about is my stance on Roe versus Wade and my stance on foreign policy and my stance on immigration. And while I'm not yet laying out a specific policy, one of the things I'm pointing out is right now, we'll just pick Roe versus Wade. The political framing of this debate is pro-life or pro-choice. Well, if you actually study the life of Donald Trump, if you read his words, if you listen to his rhetoric, if you listen to the rhetoric of most of the conservatives, they are not pro-life. They might be against abortion, but most of them don't give a crap about the life of the woman who's having the child. They have no solution for what to do with the child once it's born. Don't tell me you're pro-life if you can't bring yourself to say Black Lives Matter. Don't tell me you're pro-life if you treat women the way President Trump treats women, or immigrants the way you're not pro-life. You might be against abortion, but you are definitely not pro-life. And so the debate we're having is we are not having a debate about the value of life. We're having a politically charged debate about what a woman can or cannot do with what's growing inside of her body. And because this debate politically has been dominated for 250 years by a male-dominated Congress, a male-dominated Supreme Court, and a male-dominated White House, we are hearing some very deeply charged rhetoric coming out of this by people who aren't actually interested in debating the value of life.
How are you funding your campaign?
People can follow me online, and I have a website up, markcharles2020.com. We have a place where they can donate online there, and we've been raising money for about 6 weeks now. So that's what's funded my trip out here to the Southwest. It's what's been funding some of the travel we've been doing to film some of the videos. My announcement video that's up there, we funded some of that with what we were able to raise. But the fundraising is going slowly because I'm running as an independent, not in a Democrat or Republican primary, where there's always these deep streams, these deep networks of people willing to donate to the campaigns. We're basically growing a donor list from scratch. And as we're getting the word out, more and more people are donating, but we still have a long way to go to be able to field the full campaign staff and to have a full season of travel coming up. In fact, once I get home from this trip, I need to focus some of my energy on fundraising and getting the word out about what we're doing and inviting people to join us in this work.
Will you take PAC money?
I have not fully decided that yet. I have not had any serious conversation with anyone in a PAC. And because one of my issues is, you know, the white landowning male, which is what Citizens United was about, and elevating their voice. I haven't made a formal declaration of I will or will not take PAC money, but I'm right now I'm focused on raising as much money as I can from the grassroots, from people from the margins who are willing, sometimes for the first time, to give to a campaign.
How do you see your message resonating with people who are not Native or even people of color?
I've actually been working on this message for probably the past 5 to 10 years. As I've been speaking about the Doctrine of Discovery, as I've been trying to raise up these issues, including the need for a national dialogue on race, gender, and class, I've had to learn how to bring this dialogue to non-natives. So I've spent a lot of energy and a lot of time understanding, how do I best bring this dialogue to white America? How do I bring this dialogue into African-American communities? How do I bring this dialogue and include women or the LGBTQ community within this conversation? And so I've done a lot of research. I've put a lot of effort into figuring out, how do I state the things I state as clearly and as strongly as I state them, while still giving a vision of hope? And we're not just trying to blame or guilt people or, you know, or create victims or even heroes out of this, but we're really trying to find a way to move forward. And so this is merely an extension of what I've been doing for the past 5 years, where I've and one of the key demographics that I'm looking to communicate in this election, outside of our communities of color, outside of women, outside of the LGBTQ community, is I'm really looking to engage the millennial demographic in this dialogue. I see that the success of this campaign is really going to hinge on the millennial audience. My message resonates fairly well with people of color, resonates very well within Native communities, resonates fairly well with women, fairly well within the LGBTQ community, but this is not a majority of the nation yet. And so the great thing about millennials is millennials are the largest voting bloc in the country. And even across racial lines, millennials have been screwed by the system. They have been given a massive amount of debt, and most millennials are very prime for systemic change. And so because of the unique position of millennials right now, and because of the opportunity we have of the internet, where you can essentially have a national, even a global audience for the price of a library card, which means you can bypass the very expensive media buys that you used to have to do to get your message out to a broad audience. Now you can do it through creative and strategic social media and networking, and almost have that for free. Because of this unique mix of we have a growing population of people from the margins, we have this huge base of voters in the millennials who are primed for systemic change, and we have this closing window of the internet where for the moment you can still have a national audience for the price of a library card. That's not going to last very long. 2020 was a prime year to try and bring all this together, to actually see if we could make this not just, I'm not running a protest campaign. I'm running this to win. And the timing and the message and the running as an independent and all these things have come together where I believe the 2020 year is probably the best chance a campaign like mine has to actually be successful.
What do you want to say to the Native person who says, I'm a citizen of my nation, I vote in my tribal elections, I am not going to vote in a presidential election?
I deeply respect our Native communities who have that view. And one of the things, so on the press release I put out announcing my campaign, I stated I am a dual citizen of the Navajo, of the United States of America and the Navajo Nation. But I also acknowledge there are many people who have been burned by the system that don't want to be affiliated with it. Now, one of the things that I'm advocating is, because I'm advocating for this national dialogue on race, gender, and class, that voice is crucial to have in this dialogue. if we're going to have a dialogue about who this nation is and where are we going and deal with our past for what it actually was, which was a genocidal attack on people of color, if we're going to actually have that dialogue, we need the voices of everybody in that conversation. And so whether or not they choose to vote in this election, even whether or not they choose to vote for me, my hope is that we can create a space where their voice can be heard, because that voice is necessary if we're truly going to find a way to move forward past this.
How do you see practically this national dialogue rolling out? You know, I'm thinking about the national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada, which was essentially a gathering of stories and then a variety of other things, and culminated in this report that was mm-hmm. presented to the government. And, there's a lot of... we wish it was different, we wish it was this way or that I understood when the report came out. How can you see something like that unfolding here? Town halls? What do you really...
Yes, so this is the beauty of running for president with this at the center of my platform, where if I'm elected, essentially the nation is deciding, yes, we want to have this dialogue. Now, most of these dialogues that happen around the world happen out of crisis. So in South Africa, apartheid fell. That crisis brought parties to the table for truth and reconciliation. In Rwanda, there was a bloody civil war. In Canada, there was an over-the-top expensive lawsuit. And the risk of that lawsuit was so overwhelming that it brought the churches and the government to the table for truth and reconciliation. Now, I know our nation. We don't handle crisis well. We build internment camps in crisis. We lock children in cages in crisis. We drop nuclear bombs in crisis. We do not handle crisis well. And so I didn't want to use crisis to bring the conversation to the forefront. Also, these dialogues happen out of disruption. So we have Standing Rock. We have the Me Too movement. We have Black Lives Matter. Even the civil rights movement was this method of disruption for social change, where you march, you sit in, you protest, and then once you're heard, you co-opt the stage. Now, the moment you co-opt the stage, one of two things happens very quickly, which is either the owner of the stage takes it back or your audience leaves because they didn't come to hear you. So most of the time, you have a soundbite. Now, Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, Me Too have used this soundbite masterfully to educate the nation on the issues of these different campaigns. But the hard part is keeping the stage. Now, the civil rights movement, which was the deepest conversation we've ever had as a nation on race, one of the things that happened is the civil rights leaders, not only did they co-opt the stage, they kept it. They kept the stage. So you have to look at, well, how did they keep the stage? How did they keep the owner of the stage from taking it back and their audience from leaving? Now, one of the challenges that comes out of the civil rights movement is the way they kept the stage. And I have deep respect for our civil rights leaders. They moved the ball forward very far, and I'm deeply grateful for them. But I'm afraid that because of the way they kept the stage is what actually made the civil rights movement not as effective as it could have been. The way they kept the stage, I would argue, is through the moral authorities that they referenced as to why we needed to give civil rights to people of color. And the moral authorities that was referenced throughout the movement was our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. These were the blank checks referred to by Dr. King. So unfortunately, instead of having the conversation that our racism and our white supremacy extends down to our foundations, we basically said we have good foundations. White people just need to be better Americans. This is, I'm fairly confident, why Black Lives Matter is happening today. Because in our civil rights movement, we actually didn't get to the point of discussing that our foundations are the problem. And so this is why I'm not confident another disruption model is going to get us to dealing with land titles.
So So no town halls?
Well, so again, this is where running for president and actually bringing the dialogue to the entire nation. Now, it doesn't guarantee the nation listens. It doesn't guarantee the nation. I'm not even convinced the nation wants. So one of my questions is, I'm saying, rather than talking about when we used to be great, or how soon we'll be great again, can we just talk about, do we want to be a nation where we the people truly means all the people? Now, I'm not convinced we do. But I think we have to call that question.
How will you resolve that if the majority feels we don't?
Well, that is the challenge. So let me just, I'll lay this out a little bit. So in his final State of the Union, President Obama was talking about our need for new politics. And he said, he quoted the Constitution, he said, "We the people." Our Constitution begins with these three simple words, words we've come to recognize mean all the people. Now that sounds beautiful. He got a lot of applause for that line. But I heard him say that and I was like, when? When did we decide we the people meant all the people? The Founding Fathers didn't mean it. Abraham Lincoln didn't believe it. As good as the Civil Rights Movement was, it didn't get us there. President Trump definitely doesn't believe it. We've never decided we the people means all the people. This is the conversation we have to have. Now, I was in a session at a university, and I was talking about land titles. And someone in the audience during the Q&A, they said, well, I'm not giving my land back. This is the system that was in the nation when I got here. I'm not giving my land back. I said to that person, I said, well, that's fine. That's your decision. I said, your government is probably strong enough. You probably have enough nuclear weapons. You probably have enough money. I probably will never be able to compel you to give your land back. But you will lose your moral authority. And this is the challenge. See, the United States of America wants to be the good guys. They want to take the high road. But what I'm saying is you cannot keep the fruits of the injustice and be the good guys. I said to the student, I said, there are many nations that embrace the fact that they have no value for civil rights, they don't believe in equality, and they don't care about human life. You have communist Russia, communist China, you have North Korea, you have Syria, you have ISIS. I said, that's fine. You can keep your land. But keeping that land will come with that reputation. And according to Peter Burnett, the first governor of California, the United States of America is a genocidal nation. And if you want to live with that reputation, there's not much I can do about that. You have enough weapons. You have enough money. Your government has demonstrated they don't give a crap. So the argument I'm really framing is not, I can't make our nation want to deal with these things. I can merely ask the question and say, do we want to be a nation where we the people truly means all the people? If we do, not only do we have to pay reparations, not only do we have to deal better with immigrants, not only do we have to deal with all these other issues of giving women voice and of doing something about this paid gender discrepancy, but we have to do something about land titles. Because as recently as 2005, the Supreme Court referenced the doctrine of discovery and essentially called Native savages in building their argument as to why the Oneida Indian Nation could not reclaim sovereignty over their traditional lands that they bought and paid full price for on the open market. And until we deal with land titles, we the people will never mean all the people. Just last week, Kamala Harris, she came out with a proposal in the billions of dollars to help Black Americans purchase land, buy houses, because of what she called this racial wealth gap. Now, I don't deny a racial wealth gap exists, but I tweeted out to her. I said, I don't think, yes, while this is a problem, I agree with you, I do not think a government-funded, a taxpayer-funded program to help black people purchase lands that white people stole from native peoples is going to be the solution. That's way too simplistic. We have to deal with the root of the problem, which is our land titles are based on a dehumanizing doctrine of discovery. And until Native peoples are actually included, along with African Americans, along with LGBTQ, along with everybody else, until we deal with land titles, we are never going to get to the point where we the people actually means all the people. And that's the decision we have to make.
Mark, thanks for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be on your show. You can learn more about my campaign by following me on my website, which is markcharles2020.com. You can find me online under the username Wireless Hogan. And I'm very interested in engaging in this conversation and hopefully talking with you more in the future. So thank you very much for having me.